I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Welcome to Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books with Zivi. I'm the host, Zivi Owens. I am an author. My latest is blank, pub date March 1st, a novel. I'm also a podcaster, obviously, a publisher, a bookstore owner, and so much more. If you love books, you're in the right place. In fact, we call it the Ziviverse, or really, the LA Times called it the Ziviverse, and we're going with it. Go to ziviowens.com to learn more and follow me on Instagram at ziviowens. Susanna Breslin is the author of Data Baby, My Life in a Psychological Experiment. Susanna is a freelance journal and a Forbes.com senior contributor. From 2018 to 19, she was the Lawrence Grauman Jr. Postgraduate Fellow at UC Berkeley's Investigative Reporting Program. Her reporting and essays have appeared in The Atlantic, Slate, Harper's Bazaar, The Daily Beast, Salon, Newsweek, The Guardian, and Variety, among other media outlets. She holds a BA in English from UC Berkeley, and an MA from the Program for Writers at the University of Illinois at Chicago. She lives in Los Angeles, California. Welcome, Susanna. Thank you so much for coming on Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books to discuss your book, Data Baby, My Life in a Psychological Experiment.
Thanks so much for having me, Zibby. It's great to be here.
My pleasure. Please tell listeners about your book, about the experiment, about your parents ending up, just the whole thing.
So Data Baby is a memoir, and I grew up in Berkeley, and my father was an English professor at UC Berkeley, and the university ran a preschool where the kids who went there were also studied by professors and researchers at the university studying early childhood development. So it just so happened that when I started preschool there, I became one of over 128 kids who were followed for 30 years. And basically, the researchers who were studying us were trying to figure out, if you study a child, can you predict who that child will grow up to be? At the time, there was this crisis in psychology about whether or not personality traits were real. Do people actually have a distinct personality, or are they just responding to the circumstances in which they find themselves? And the only way to sort of identify that and find out if personality remained relatively stable over time was by following people from childhood into adulthood, which is exactly what they did.
And when did you know that this had happened?
So I'm not sure. The analogy that I've given before is, it's kind of, in my mind, it's kind of like being adopted for somebody who always knew they were adopted. They don't remember having like a sit-down conversation. It was just kind of always there. I don't remember a time in my life when I wasn't involved in the study. But when I was a preschooler, when I was around 4 years old, I wasn't aware of what was actually going on behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. So that preschool was designed essentially for studying children. It had mirror twin classrooms, and between those classrooms, there was an observation gallery where people could essentially hide and watch what we were doing. And there was a transparent screen that hid them, but they could also hear what we were saying. And then later we were assessed on campus in Tolman Hall, which was where the psychology department was. And those experiment rooms had one-way mirrors, although to me, they just appeared to be mirrors. I think sometime around, 7 or 8 years old, I kind of started to figure out these adults are interested in me and there's a little bit something more going on here than I might have thought.
And what is your view on whether personality is a stable trait?
I'm not a scientist. I don't have a PhD. I'm not a psychologist or a researcher. And so that was sort of one of the challenges of writing the book. I'm a journalist. I'm a writer. I'm not an expert, but I've had experts studying me. Researchers come from the premise that what is in front of them is quantifiable. And I think what I ultimately took away from investigating my past and the story behind the study once I grew up was that there is something about people that's beyond science that can't simply be reduced to something that is quantifiable. We were essentially, as a cohort, a data set. And I certainly like to think I'm something more than, a bucket of data.
I think you're more than a bucket of data.
Well, thank you. That's right.
I was a psychology major in college, and I went through hours and hours of coding children's behavior. I was doing eating and weight research, but it was like the snack of an actual study. Like they were doing a study on something else, but they had this free moment where they gave the kid snack. And instead of just throwing that footage away, the eating and weight department was like, oh, wait, let's study that and see if there are any links to it. All to say, I spent a lot of time coding for every different behavior. So I am aware of the ins and outs of studies and psychological experiments and all of that. And to be in one for so long, oh my gosh, that's a lot.
It was, when I was an adult, I would tell people I was in the study and people would always be like, oh, that's really strange, or that sounds so weird, or why did your parents let you do that? When did you find out? All those questions. And it was always so normal to me. And I was a journalist for many, many years before I even really strongly considered writing about this. It was so much a part of me. Mm-hmm. And I think in a lot of ways actually shaped me that it didn't seem unusual to me. But I understand it seems weird to grow up and have people like spying on you. And one thing that was weird when I started doing the research into the story was finding out that I had a number. My number in the study is 758. And that was just jarring. It was kind of like, am I this number? I had a very sort of romantic vision of what the study was. They made me feel special. I felt like I was part of something that was bigger than myself. It gave me a sense of meaning in my life. And to sort of reconcile that with being a number and looking at yourself as like part of a mathematical calculation took some mental gymnastics, you could say.
Have you watched the reality show Squid Game? So in the reality show, everybody gets a number. That's why I'm bringing it up.
Okay.
So you all wear the same thing and everyone gets assigned a number and they don't use your names ever. And so it's like, oh, remember that guy 58 who got eliminated last week? And yeah. Da-da-da-da. And you see how it makes people feel when they're all, you lose your identity. Right? How do you maintain an identity when you're just another number? Okay, but your book is not just about the experiment. It's not all science. You go into a lot about your personal life and everything. And can I read like a small section of it? Is that okay?
Of course.
Okay, this is from chapter 6. You said, 3 weeks later in mid-September, I was on a plane heading west. As I watched the verdant landscape slipping away far below me through the oval window, it seemed like I could see things more clearly from this bird's eye point of view. Bird, that's it. I was a bird in a gilded cage. I had all the trappings of the good life, a house, a partner, a BMW, and a 3-car garage. And once I had those things, I didn't want to lose them. For decades, I had struggled to take care of myself. It was hard to picture giving up everything. You'll be fine, I could hear some wiser version of myself, of me telling myself. I knew if I left my husband, I could take care of myself. But what if the breast cancer came back? Better the devil you know than the devil you don't, I considered. But what if the devil kills me? So far, my husband had only threatened to hit me, but what if he actually did? What then? My goodness. So.
Yeah, I waited a long time to get married. I grew up in Berkeley. My mother was a feminist and my father left her when I was 10. And she told me over and over again, don't get married. Men want you to take care of them, but they don't want to take care of you. And I think for her, having children was an impediment to her professional ambitions. She was an English professor, but my father's career as an English professor as well was more successful than hers. And I think she felt like she paid the price of being a mother and a wife. And then he left. And so I always had that voice in the back of my head, essentially saying, you can't trust men. You know, it was in relationships, but I didn't get married until I was 43. So when I was 43, I was on a dating app and I met a man and we fell in love and I got married in Vegas 9 days after we went on our first date. So it was very much like a whirlwind romance. And then 4 days after that, I was diagnosed with breast cancer during a routine mammogram. So it was, at the time, I actually felt like I was being punished for betraying what my mother had told me to do. It seemed very clear cut. So the honeymoon was over immediately, and it was challenging to walk through that breast cancer process and figure out how to be a wife and still retain my sense of self at the same time. You know, ultimately, the marriage was not what I thought it would be. And I found myself, we married in Illinois, but moved to Florida and found myself in the role of an executive's wife, living in a house in a planned community where all the houses looked very similar. And there was like a fake lake behind our house that would like periodically shoot up this stream of water. And it was so far from where I had started in, you know, Berkeley is amazing history and this crazy creative place. And I was studied when I was a kid. My parents were English professors. There was this sense of, you know, you're exceptional in some way. And I felt at that time when I was married that I was simply like a supporting actor in somebody else's life. And so the part of what I wanted to understand, you know, I had survived cancer, was like, well, what is my purpose here? Is this who I'm actually supposed to be? And that's part of why I got interested in the study and asking myself, well, who did they think I would be? You know, did they think I was going to win a Nobel Prize, or did they think I was going to end up in, you know, sort of rotting my brain in suburbia? And ultimately, that investigation into myself was not compatible with the marriage that I was in. And essentially, I sort of exploded my life ultimately and got divorced and pursued the story that I tell in the memoir, which ultimately took me back to Berkeley for a year, where I was a fellow at the investigative program at the university, trying to understand how the study, I think, played ultimately a role in shaping the person I became in ways that I didn't fully understand until I started looking into it.
So you would recommend waiting more than 9 days to get married, or you would not recommend it?
Well, I've said before, it's a great story until it isn't, right? I wouldn't recommend it. I wouldn't do it again. But, you know, people do it. People have arranged marriages. You know, I haven't lived a super normal life, and I do kind of pride myself on throwing myself into things that didn't work out. You know, the process of writing the book and publishing it is hard for me because I find so much of it embarrassing. Recounting my failures publicly is not like on my list of things that I love doing. And there's a lot of failing and flopping and insecurity and missteps in that story. But I have tried throughout my life to do what I think to be brave. My mother lived with a lot of fear and inhibition and resentment and paralysis. And I always just wanted to be courageous as a journalist, or, you know, in the things that I pursued. I don't want to come down too hard on some of the crazy decisions that I've made.
And I was totally just joking around.
Oh, I know.
Look, I've made so many bad decisions. I mean, that's part of life, right? We do these things, you know. I can almost understand, I can understand why you would do it that way though, because if you've been so cautioned against making a mistake or doing something wrong, it's like you have to just like blindfold and like run through the rain. You know what I mean? Like, okay, I'm going to make a mad dash for it, right? It makes sense in a way. Like you either have to do it that way, or else you'll be in your head about it for so long.
And right.
So yeah, I get it.
I tend to overthink things, mm-hmm. or act very impetuously. I'm sort of good at the polars and not so great at like the balanced approach.
Yeah. No, I totally understand. I make a lot of decisions and I'm like, yes, let's do this right now. And then eventually I'll have to be like, okay, let me think about the ripple of that.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Sometimes we all have stuff we need to get off our chests. Even if we don't think it's interfering with our daily life, there are some things you just haven't processed, be it grief or trauma, eating disorders, anything. It might be time to work on those things, and I have a solution for you. Therapy. Online therapy by BetterHelp. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. I took the brief questionnaire online where there were, 20 questions. It didn't take long at all, maybe 3 minutes. And then I got matched with a therapist who could help me work on whatever. I picked trauma because even though it happened in 2001, I am somehow still not over the loss of my friend on 9/11. And it is what it is. BetterHelp is going to help. And I am so excited, especially because with my special code, instead of $80 a month, it is 10% off, $72 a month, which is so much less than traditional therapy. And you'll get a perfect therapist for you. There are 35,000 therapists to choose from, so you'll find the right one. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/momsdonthavetime today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/momsdonthavetime. So, how is your health now?
Great. Totally fine. It's been like 11 years, I think.
Okay, good. Knocking wood for you. Not wanting to put your mistakes on display doesn't necessarily jive well with putting out a memoir at all. Yeah. It's like part of the territory. Did you think about sort of writing this for yourself and not publishing it, or leaving chunks out or anything like that?
It's a good question. I've said I became a writer because it was the only thing I did well. I love writing. It's been my career. And the idea of writing something for myself actually seems like sort of a waste of time. And I do like to write and share. I think I just didn't realize how vulnerable a position writing a memoir would put me in and how hard that would be for me. One thing I talk about in the book is there's a lot of pressure on me growing up. The study made me feel special, but it also kind of made me feel like I had to perform. My parents thought I was smart and had hopes that I would be as sort of successful as they were. And so I put a lot of pressure on myself. And I'm very intolerant of any sort of imperfections that I have. A memoir is a kind of parade of imperfections, and it's about sharing your feelings, which is not something I'm good at all. You know, being studied or having the type of mother I had who was intellectual and distant doesn't make you into a person who's good at sharing their feelings. Mm-hmm. And there is a kind of way in which I tried to respect that in myself in the memoir. And I almost have a journalistic relationship to myself in my story. So I think it's not a sort of typical memoir in that way. I have a complicated relationship to memoirs. I think they can be kind of like just a vomiting of feelings, often written by women for women. I don't really like the idea idea personally that women are sort of supposed to be relegated to a literary genre that's all about feelings, and maybe men are the ones who are better suited for like telling the stories of the world. And so I sort of struggled with a straitjacket as I experienced of writing a memoir. And how could this be about something more than simply my own interior? Because I have something to say about the world that goes beyond like how I'm feeling or my personal journey.
Right. There's a line between sort of nonfiction and memoir, right? Like reported stories and, you know, it's, you know, science, nonfiction books with you as a subject. That's a very different book than a memoir. Or what you think of traditionally as a memoir. Like, are there any books that when you were writing yours, you were like, well, I just want it to be like this one?
You know, I love, one of my favorite books is Marguerite Duras' The Lover, where she, I think she published it or wrote it when she was 70. And the opening scene about is her encountering a man when she's older, and he looks at her and says, I like the way you, I'm paraphrasing terribly, but he's basically saying, I like the way your face is better now. He says, it's ravaged. So there's this kind of brutal honesty. She's muddying the, it's based on a true story, but do they sell it as a novel or a memoir? Like, I don't even know. You know, a memoir is a story the author tells you about themselves, but is it the whole story? Is it the most true story? And what is the true story? I prefer stories that understand the limitations of what we consider to be true.
Love that. So tell me about the process of writing the book. Was it emotional? What was it like on a day-to-day basis?
It was just terrible. I mean, it's just, I feel like I should lie, right? Like,
don't
I
lie. Like, no.
But I feel like when I'm supposed to give an answer, I'm like, oh my God, it was like, I really had to go deep, you know, and I really had to like connect with my core. And then I found like when I started telling my story, I just like really came into myself. And then I was done, and then it was published, and then it like came out. I was like, oh my God, like I am now a fully actualized human being. That was not my experience of it. It was just agonizing. It never got easy. I had really intense migraines, I think from the stress. One, it went on for a really long period of time. I felt like I didn't have an ending. And the book came out in late last year in 23, but in 2022, in June, my mother died. And I had become estranged from her by that point, but she kind of gave me in dying a third act. Mm. And, you know, we always had like a curious bond. I was born on her birthday, her 30th birthday. And when she died, I think it allowed, it kind of freed me up to tell my own story as if it was my own. You know, I think the fact that we kind of shared a birthday, it was like my own birthday is not quite my own. My story is not quite my own. And when she kind of psychically got out of my way, I was able to move forward on the book that I, in a way that I hadn't. In addition, I hired a freelance editor who was just amazing. Petronelle Van Arsdale is her name, who I started calling her my book doula. And in a way, she was like a substitute mom for the baby I was delivering, which was my book. And being able to ask for and get the help that I needed was impactful. And the book would not have ever been finished without that help that I was able to ask for and get, which I think was something that was hard to do.
Well, I'm so sorry about your experience.
Like, I'm such a complainer, but
no, don't be silly. I mean, it's hard. It's all hard. It's not roses and rainbows. You know, this is complicated terrain to navigate. And it's just so nice to hear the truth, right? That it's not always perfect. It's not always easy. So you might as well tell it. And I'm sorry about your mom and her passing. I'm glad it enabled you to figure out a way through, but sorry that you had to go through that as a means to an end. But I also understand that. Do you have any advice to aspiring authors? But don't just say not to do it.
Don't write a memoir, ever.
Don't ever write a memoir. Turn off this podcast immediately.
You know, another thing that complicated my own creative process is I've been a freelance journalist for over 20 years, and I'm kind of a lone wolf operator professionally. and I like to sort of live on the fringe. This book was different in that regard, in that it had an agent and I sold it on a proposal. And so the creation of the book itself took place in part within the capitalist machinery of book publishing, which I did not feel was particularly compatible with the creative process. And what I would encourage writers to do is to find their voice outside of the economic system if they can. Either find other ways to make money so you can write as you wish, or you can do what I've done, which is sort of bifurcate your writing abilities, which I have, you know, a set of writing that I do, journalistic or copywriting or whatever, that I do for money, where I make compromises and collaborate. But then I also have my own work, which is fiction or different types of essays or what I write in my blog, where I'm writing just for myself. And I think writing for the market, writing for the audience is not writing what you want to write. That's what writing for the market and writing for an audience or writing for somebody you think might read it who lives inside of your head is not, that's not you. Then you're just figuring out what somebody else wants. And women already have enough of that in their lives, right? Who do my parents want me to be? Who does my spouse want me to be? Who do my friends want me to be? And I think I would like to hear more stories from women that are creative and original and are just born from that woman, rather than in service of giving something else to somebody else. Hmm.
But interestingly, you said it might seem like a waste if you just wrote for you at the beginning.
I know, I'm incredibly contradictory. So I don't know what the answer is. I mean, I will write for myself, but then I will publish it. I'll mm-hmm. publish it like online. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to write for myself and put it away in a drawer.
No, I get it.
I think the creative process should take place outside of the market, ideally.
Yes.
But then you can put it in the market.
Then you put it in. Yes.
Yeah.
Backstage.
That's my advice.
I got it. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Susanna. I really appreciate you coming on. Congratulations sure. on your book. And for your sake, I'm glad it's done.
Thank you so much, Zibby. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks for listening to this episode of Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. Don't forget to follow me on Instagram at Zibby Owens and at Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. Also sign up for my newsletter at ZibbyOwens.com and sign up for my virtual book club and meet lots of authors on Zoom every other week. Thanks so much to Steve and Ryan at Texture Sound for the sound editing. And thank you to Morning Moon Productions for providing this fantastic intro and outro music.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.